Greetings, this is a reading of the book, The Airship Golden Hind. Some of the language in this book has not aged well and is indeed no longer politically correct. Take caution when listening to this visual audiobook. Footage and photography are provided by Fortations. At Fortation, we believe that the world would be a better place if people spent their time being creative, join us, and practicing art so we all can be the master of art. Fine art prints available at our store, www.fortationstore.com. Keep our artwork alive by making a donation at fortationsdonations.com. The Airship Golden Hind by Percy F. Westerman. Chapter 23, A Dumping Operation. The heavily laden Golden Hind resumed her delayed journey. Both gas bags and planes had to do their full share of work to keep the airship afloat. She was flying low, but making good progress. But so little was her reserve of buoyancy that had the three Huns who perished in the catastrophe to 64 been saved, it was doubtful whether Fosterdijk could have carried on. To make matters worse, some of the patches on the repaired ballonets were leaking, for owing to the heat of the rubber, the solution was not holding well. I wonder if Drake's Golden Hind, when she arrived in the Thames, after circumnavigating the globe, was patched up like we are in Mark Kenyon. It took Drake 3 long years to do the trick, and we look like completing our voyage in under 17 days. If the old bus holds out, added Bramston. Tenere, no one can say we haven't done our bit. The Golden Hind's been a regular sort of aerial lifeboat. That is some satisfaction. I'd rather we did that than win the race. I suppose our passengers won't get up to any of their Hunnish tricks, observed Kenneth. Trust Fosterdijk for that, replied Peter grimly. He's had M placed in the dining saloon. Fortunately, we won't require many more meals. They can amuse themselves there without getting into mischief. There's one of our fellows stationed outside to keep the blighters in order. Just then the baronet came upon the scene. Bonsens, it looks like pulling it off. He observed a wireless from the S1 watch reports that a monoplane passed over the ship at 6 p.m. flying east. According to the position given, the Wantwash was only 35 miles west of Gibraltar. Then perhaps he's back at his hangar by this time, commented Peter. Any news of the others? Yes. Commodore Theodore Nye has been unable to get hold of another bus yet, although two of the Australian RAF pilots are bringing him a Bristol machine from Melbourne. He's out of the running, that he admits, but he means to complete the course, even if it takes him 6 months. And the chap? Asked Kenyon. Not a word, replied the baronet. He's keeping quiet. But mark my words, that quadruplin will turn up unexpectedly. If his bus had had British motors, he would have romped home in less than a week. What engines has he? Asked Bramston. Japanese, replied Fosterdijk, passable imitations of ours and good up to a certain point. But give me British engines all the jolly old time. Although the baronet made frequent inquiries of the operator, no wireless messages concerning von Sennzig came through. Perhaps he's crashed, suggested Peter. Not he, replied Kenyon. That Hun's got the luck of a cat with nine lives. He's playing his own game. It is a game, added Bramston. Loading that crowd of Huns onto us is like a man in a mile race checking his gear to another competitor and telling him to hang on. I don't wish the blighter any harm, but I do hope that if he pulls off the money prize, they'll pay him in German marks at the pre-war rate of exchange. That'd make him look blue. Although no news came in concerning their Hun rival, the officers and crew of the Golden Hind began to be bombarded with wireless messages from Britons in every quarter of the globe. All were of the most encouraging nature, for the story of Foster Dyke's airship and her adventures and misadventures, all more or less distorted owing to the lack of authentic detail, had awakened worldwide interest. There were cheering messages from patriotic Britons and scented ones from sportsmen, to whom the suggestion of a race appealed more than did the fact that the contest was one of endurance calculated to uphold the prestige of British flying men. Frenchmen, Dutchmen, Norwegians, Americans, and Japanese all sent greetings to the intrepid British airmen. "Didn't know we had so many friends," remarked Foster Dyke, sportsmanlike of those Americans and Japs, too, when they have representatives in the show. The Golden Hind was now approaching the regular mail line, where routes to and from the Cape and round the Horn unite in the neighborhood of Las Palmas. "We'll signal the first vessel we sight," decided Sir Reginald, "and get her to relieve us of our cargo of Fritz's. The sooner the better, because several of the baronets are showing distinct symptoms of porosity." 5 minutes later, the airship had slowed down and had swung round on a course parallel to a homeward-bound Dutchman. The skipper of the latter, when appealed to by a megaphone, stoutly refused to receive the 17 Germans. He gave no reason why he should not do so, and without waiting for further parley, ran for full speed ahead. A little later, a French auxiliary barque was sighted, bound south. Foster Dyke made no attempt to intercept her. "Here are limits," he observed. "Them being those Huns on board an outward bound Frenchman is one of them. Now for the next vessel." "Three for look." The third was a British tram, bound from Montevideo for Naples. Her old man, although ignorant that a round-the-world aerial race was in progress, or even in contemplation, readily agreed to help the Golden Hind on her way. "I'll find use for 'em," he added with infinite relish. "They'll work their passage. Never you fear. 3 times I've been torpedoed without warning, and on 2 occasions Fritz popped up to jeer at us struggling in waterlogged boats." While conversation was in progress between Foster Dyke and the master of the S. Diaphanus, a wire hawser had been lowered from the bows of the airship and made fast to the trams after a winch. Since she was steaming dead in the eye of the wind, there was no necessity for her to alter her helm. The Golden Hind, pitching slowly, was towed astern of and 30 feet above the tram. As the airship's course was almost identical with that of the tram, Foster Dyke conscientiously kept the propellers revolving, since even in the present circumstances, he did not wish to give his rivals a chance of raising a protest on the score that the flight of the British airship had been mechanically aided. The 17 Germans showed no great enthusiasm at being placed on board the tram. At first, they imagined that the Diaphanus was bound for the Pacific. Even the prospect of being dumped ashore at Naples was not at all attractive. When they did make a move, they descended the rope ladder so slowly and deliberately that it was obvious they meant to detain the Golden Hind as much as possible. "I see through their little game," exclaimed Foster Dyke. "Angrily make 'em get a move on, Jackson." The leading hand wanted no further bidding. Ably seconded by Chief Erdekanek, Hayward, he gave vent to such a flow of forcible language, accompanied by realistic dementia, that the Huns changed their tactics completely. It was even necessary to check their impetuosity, lest the latter should break under the weight of too many men descending simultaneously. Then, with a joyous toot on her side, as the hawser was cast off, and a stentorian greeting from the mercantile marine skipper, the Diaphanous gathered away, while the Golden Hind, almost as buoyant as of yore, rose steadily and rapidly against the gentle breeze. 2 hours later, when the Moroccan coast was sighted on the starboard boat, then 50 minutes later, Foster Dick touched Kenyon on the shoulder and pointed dead ahead to a faint object rising above the horizon. "Guess we've done the trick, barring accidents," he observed. "That's Gibraltar."